Sabrina?
Okay, everybody, here we go with our new hit record, Sugar, Sugar!
Sugar.
Well, our next guest on Downtown has had quite a remarkable career. Oh, yeah, he's the lead singer of the Archies, that multi-million selling number one song from 1969. He was all of the voices that produced the top 10 hit Tracy by a group known as the Cufflinks back in 1969. He went on to a successful career as a music producer and then turned his talents to Broadway, where he produced award-winning shows like Ain't Misbehavin' and Children of a Lesser God. And he's still out there making music today, getting ready to gear up for the Happy Together tour, where he'll be the lead vocalist for the Turtles, along with Mark Volman. We are so happy to be joined by Ron Dante, talking about his career in the business. We caught up with Ron earlier this afternoon. Ron, thank you so much for being with us.
You bet.
We're set to go and rolling, if you're ready.
I'm ready. Born ready.
Well, I guess you were. Was so much to talk about. Let's go back, I guess, almost to the beginning here. Am I right that it was a family friend who was one of the singers in the Elegants, the guys who did Little Star, that helped inspire you to a career in the music business?
They certainly did. One of the fellas in the group worked for my dad, and he was a close family friend, and he went from you know, working for my dad to being on the road as a star in that group with Little Star. So they took me to my first recording session.
And you started...
I watched them record their follow-up to Little Star, and it just inspired me. Also, I was a huge fan of Elvis at the time. So that combined with seeing how records were made got me going.
And you started very young. When did you first come in contact and begin working with Don Kirshner?
You know, I was turning 17 years old, and I auditioned for his music publishing company. And the staff writers there auditioned me first. And they said, well, you can play guitar and you can sing, and we like the way your voice sounds. You probably can write a song. So they took me in to see Mr. Kirshner. And he listened to my little song I had written and said, we're going to sign you to a publishing deal, and you're going to be the staff singer demo maker. I would sing for all the other writers at Don Kirshner's publishing company. It was very interesting. Kirshner, I walked in the office the first day, right? And who was sitting at a desk but Neil Sedaka? The other place was Carole King. And then there was another one with Tony Orlando.
Wow.
And they all were very friendly to me, especially Tony Orlando and Neil Sedaka.
And one of the, I think, advantages of being a session singer and doing demos is that you learn to sing in a lot of different styles, and you get to really, if you can do it, expand your vocal range, too.
It really helped to be asked to sing like the stars of the day, like Gary Lewis and the Playboys, or Bobby V, or Herman's Hermits, any of those groups that were out. I was very fortunate that I had a pretty good range already, so I could sing high, low, and I could imitate people a little bit. And that really helped me. Also, I learned the way to handle a microphone and how to not over-sing on a microphone when I was doing those demos. So it was like going to music college, working in that office, because I've got to sing backgrounds on a lot of people's hits and lead on a few of the hits. It was really interesting.
How did you get involved with the Detergents?
Well, at the time, I was still working with Don Kirshner's publishing company. He had been absorbed by Screen Gems Columbia, so it became Screen Gems Music. And my two writing partners up there, Danny Jordan and Tommy Wynn, we were writing songs together. We were trying to write some hits. And Danny Jordan's uncle, was a hit songwriter named Paul Vance. He had written Itsy Bitsy Teeny Weeny Yellow Polka Dot Bikini. So Danny said, my uncle's doing a session. He needs some singers to come in and do put some voices on some tracks. So we showed up at the studio, and Paul asked us to sing a little, to act a little. And we did like five different sections. I never heard it put together until like 3 weeks later when I heard it on the radio, and it was in the Battle of Singles for the week, and it was called Leader of the Laundromat. I didn't know what the title was going to be. I had no idea. And then the name of the group was The Detergent. That's what Paul came up with, you know, kind of a crazy. We were the first Weird Al's kind of
that's right.
parroting the big hit, because we parodied the Shangri-La's big hit of Leader of the Pack. And it was a great thing to do because it had motorcycles in it. It had a death scene. It was really funny.
We're talking with Ron Dante here on Downtown. 1969 was such a huge year for you. Now, which came first, the Cufflinks or the Archies?
You know, the Archies came first. I was already working with them in 1968, recording songs for the TV show, the Archies TV show, animated TV show on CBS. And so I was already into it. But during that time, again, Paul Vance called me and said, would you come and sing this demo for us on a song we've just written called Tracy? So I went in, I put my voice down about 20 times on it, and I made up some backgrounds. And I didn't think it would be released. I thought it was a demo for some other artist. But about 3 or 4 weeks later, that came out as a group called The Cufflinks, and it was a big hit, and it was amazing. So The Cufflinks came after The Archies.
Yeah, The Cufflinks, I was looking back at some of the old covers of the 45, the single release, and there were three guys on there, but you were all the voices, right?
Yes, I did a whole album in a week. I recorded the whole album. I put the voice on, lead voice, then I did, and I made up some background. So it would sound like a group like the Turtles or the Association. A lot of bop-bop-bops and a lot of stuff on the backgrounds. But, yeah, I was not on the road with the group that they put together, but they were just lip-syncing most of my lead vocals.
Now, Sugar Sugar became such a mammoth hit. We had Andy Kim on the show a while back, and then he told some great stories about the making of the record, the fact that Ray Stevens stopped by to add some hand claps in the recording process, the great work of Tony Wine along with you. And then also about how Don Kirshner really showed his skills as a promotion man, getting that song played at a time when it didn't sound like a lot of other hits that were on the radio.
It's true. Don Kirshner was the supreme promoter and supreme music man. I mean, he knew a hit song. He knew hit songwriters and producers. He gave more stars their start than almost any other guy in the music business. So when he was involved, you always knew you had a big chance for a hit record. And he was a great guy to be in the studio with. He was friendly. He always ordered food, and everybody was taken care of in the studio. It was a great experience working for Don Kirshner. And he always hired the best producers. He hired Jeff Barry, one of the supreme songwriter producers of the 60s.
You also got to show off your vocal range and tap into those falsetto skills with the follow-up for the Archies.
Yes, well, when they came up, I was very amazed that the follow-up song was going to be something that was out of my range. And I think they originally wanted that track for the girl singer, Tony Wine, but they still wanted my voice on it. So they said, you sing lead. I said, well, you know, it's a little high. They said, well, just use your falsetto, which I always had a good falsetto. So I did the whole thing in false, and Tony Wine did the answers. Miss Tony Wine, she was a great singer, did the answers, and I did the lead. But it was a challenge. I was very surprised they put that out as the follow-up to Sugar Sugar, because the Sugar Sugar sound, the vocal I put on that was the hit sound. And I thought they should follow it up with a similar sound and in a range I could sing. So I was very surprised, although it wasn't a big top 10 hit, and it did sell a million records. So, you know, Kirshner was right about that. But in hindsight, I would have used my lower voice on the follow-up.
Now, your voice was also everywhere in those days, Ron. You were doing a lot of commercial work and jingles. So what are some of the most memorable ones for you?
Well, I did a lot of soft drinks. I did Pepsi, Coke, Dr. Pepper, 7-Up, Sprite. I did a lot of commercials for those. My biggest one was the Pepsi commercial, You've Got a Lot to Live, and Coke, Coke Is It. So I did a bunch of commercials then. I was doing hundreds of commercials a year, It was really my business to be a jingle singer. You go in, they put the song in front of you, you read it, and then you make it sound like a pop song. It was an amazing time, because I'd listen to local radio, and in the course of 1 hour, I would hear Sugar Sugar, by the Archies. I would hear Tracy by the Cufflinks, and then I'd hear a few of my commercials. So it was like the Ron Dante hour. It was a wonderful experience to know that your voice was being heard by millions and millions of people.
Now, if I remember right, it was on a shoot for a Coke commercial that you worked for the first time with Barry Manilow and started a wonderful collaboration.
Yes, as one of the commercials I was hired for was for a product for Coke or Pepsi, and the writer of the commercial and arranger was this fella named Barry Manilow. And I remember thinking, boy, this is a really good spot. Good melody, good lyric, and a great arrangement. So they brought me in to sing along with the group, and the group was Barry Manilow and me, and then it was Melissa Manchester and Valerie Simpson from Ashford and Simpson. So it was an illustrious vocal group. All of us had just begun our careers. I also had a few hits already. So I was like the only one who had a couple of chart hits. But Barry afterwards asked me if I'd like to hear some of his original songs, and he wanted to be a solo artist. And I listened to it a couple of days later. I heard some of his solo songs, and he played me Could It Be Magic and I Am Your Child. And I said, well, this is a very, very talented guy. I loved his voice, I loved his arranging, and I loved his songs. So that started a 9-year commitment to produce records with him.
The song that hit for him, finally got him some huge chart success, though, was not a Barry Manilow composition. You took a song that had been written and recorded by Scott English that was called Brandy, and you slowed it down. How did you find what proved to me to be, I think, the ultimate Barry Manilow sound by taking somebody else's song but tailoring it to his skills and talent?
It had a lot to do with Barry's arranging skills. The original demo and the original record of Brandy was kind of up-tempo. It was not a serious ballad. And Barry walked into the studio, and we tried it up-tempo. It didn't work. Then he said, well, let me try this. And he went out and he started to play bum bum dun 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 dun, the little lick at the beginning of the song. And that was his arrangement made the song. And we only had two other musicians in the studio with him at the time. Jimmy Young on drums and Will Lee on bass, and Barry at the piano. So I made sure that he was isolated vocally, and he sang the lead. And that's the lead that you hear on the record, was what we recorded that night with three musicians. Afterwards, I added background voices, we added strings and horns, and I did a supreme mix on it. I took my time with that mix, made sure it was perfect for his voice. And Mandy exploded. I mean, people would hear it on the radio and drive their car off the road just to listen to it.
Now, I read an interview where you said that you thought the best album that you produced with Barry, and I think I would agree with this, was Even Now.
Yes, Even Now was a labor of love. All the right songs, all the right arrangements. We had moved studios, so we were in another studio that I loved in California. But it was an amazing, amazing time to do the Even Now album. I was so happy to work with Barry. All the his voice was in perfect condition as it is today, and he was ready to read those lyrics and make them his own. So the Even Now, everything came together in that album. I was just so happy to work on that, and as I was to work on all the albums. But I'm one of the. If I had to pick one album, I would say the Even Now album is my favorite.
And some great singles, but I thought a super song from that album that was never released as a single, but it was a song that Barry wrote with Marty Panzer, a great version of "Leaving in the Morning."
I always loved that one. I was you know, we just had so many singles in that album that we never got around to releasing that one because we were working on the next album. So it was interesting. I'm glad you like that one. It's a beautiful song.
And then you went on to produce for people like Cher and Pat Benatar. What makes a good producer, Ron?
Well, I think a producer has to sublimate his ego to not put his imprint on the production, but put the artist's imprint on the production. Always remember that the people listening love the artist. And they want to hear the artist. They want to hear the artist surrounded by beautiful things and things that enhance the vocal. So I think a good producer has to know a lot. He has to be like the jack of all trades, but a master of all. He's got to know the engineering side of it, the arranging side of it, especially the vocal side of it. When an artist gets in the studio and starts to sing that song, they have to feel totally, totally secure about the environment and that they're being appreciated and they're being nurtured. So I think a good producer has to know all those things. Mm. I'm a producer who comes out of the singer school of producing. I always think about the singer first, and everything comes afterwards. The arrangement, the engineering, the mastering, all that stuff is secondary. Other engineers, like the great Phil Ramone, who is a major engineer of great and producer of great artists, it was an engineer, sound man, who came out of it from the sound man perspective, I think. What was on the board, what kind of filters were on the instruments. I was always involved in the emotion of the project and getting that across.
I think Peter Asher told us a good producer is also a good psychologist.
That has a lot to do with it. I was very fortunate to work with really, really talented and professional people. Everybody showed up, did their job beautifully, and we were always in sync. There was never any conflicts.
We're talking with Ron Dante on Downtown. 1978, you continued to produce, but this time for the Broadway stage, a massive hit celebrating the songs of Fats Waller, Ain't Misbehavin', with an incredible cast, Nell Carter, Andre DeShields. What was that experience like for you?
Well, it was just fabulous to be able to go into all the recording studios in New York are centered in the Broadway district theaters around there. So I had always envisioned that someday I might produce and work on a musical that was in one of those great theaters. And Ain't Misbehavin' was my opportunity. A good friend of mine named James Lipton, who had the Actors Studio show.
Oh, yes.
On TV, met him at a party. And he said to me, there's an opening for producing Ain't Misbehavin', which is at the Manhattan Theater Club. And I just loved the idea. I jumped right in, and I helped them secure an album deal with RCA, so there was a cast album. And I even recorded a disco album that incorporated some of the songs from the Broadway show. But it was a great experience. It's much different than the music business. The theater business is its own world, and you have to know how to work with these people. It's a very big money thing. And most of my friends in music and records said, don't get involved in Broadway. Everybody loses money. And I thought, well, Ain't Misbehavin' is going to be a big winner. And sure enough, it was.
Well, and you had big success a while later with a Tony Award-winning drama, Children of a Lesser God.
Yes, I was very happy to see that. I had flown out to Los Angeles to see it downtown. And I called my partner at the intermission, and I said, we should produce this show on Broadway. It's a beautiful, beautiful show that rivals Miracle Worker. I said, it's got such depth. And sure enough, we put together the package and produced that and won the Tony. And it won a couple of Tonys for the actors. And it became a wonderful film, I thought, with Marlee Matlin and William Hurt.
Now, along the way, or I think around the time you were producing Broadway shows, you were neighbors with George Plimpton?
Yes. Yes, on the Upper East Side, my building was attached to his building, and we became friends. One night, he had a fire in his apartment, and my wife and I ran in and helped him get his baby out. And we became fast friends, and he had a pool table in his apartment, and we would play pool once a week together. And he was one of those great guys that, he did TV, he wrote books. He was one of those great people that you could never get tired of hearing what he had to say, his stories. He was a very, very close friend, and I was so happy to be his buddy. We would go to Elaine sometimes together. it was always fun.
And you ended up working with the Paris Review, right?
Yeah, one night we said, the Paris Review needs a publisher. The publisher is bowing out. We need the support. He said, let's play this game of pool. If I beat you, you become the publisher. And I always had beaten him. But that night he ran the table. And that's the story. And I became the publisher of the Paris Review, and I got to help with the covers. The covers were always the best artwork in the world. Every time they put it out, there would be somebody else on the cover that was magnificent. And, we got interviews with the finest new writers around, great stories. It was, again, another world. that are so different than the music business that I was in, that I just had the most fun in, because there was so many discoveries in that world, meeting people, George's parties. You could meet Jackie Onassis and Muhammad Ali and Woody Allen at the same party. You know, it was like unbelievable. I met Tennessee Williams one night.
Oh, wow.
He asked me to play a song at the piano for him. I said, this is a dream come true.
Well, you're still out there making people smile with your music. A couple of years ago, was it that Howard Kalin of the Turtles decided to come off the road? He had some health issues, and you've stepped in since then as part of the wonderful Happy Together tour, working with Mark Volman.
Yes, I became a turtle. I tell everybody, I am so thrilled to be the lead singer of the Turtles. I get to sing Happy Together every night. And in these times, don't we need Happy Together? Mm. It just feels right. We're going out again this summer. Another 60 cities will be playing from late May to early September. And on the bill will be the Vogues, the Cowsills, Gary Puckett and the Union Gap, I forgot the last fella, but a bunch of us are going to be on the road again. And I'm really looking forward. Chuck Nygren of the Three Dog Night will be on the show. So it's a really full night of all hits. And I love being a turtle, because after singing the Archie songs, the Cuffley songs all these years, it was wonderful to have a brand new catalog of hits that the Turtles had. They had such wonderful songs. They're perfect for a singer like me.
Well, and of course, we play a lot of those songs here on our station. But what is it about those songs, whether it's the Turtles or the Cufflinks or the Archies, to think that those songs are still being listened to and finding new audiences all these years later? What is it about them that's given them such staying power?
You know, I call it the golden age of songwriting and recording and singing. There was no auto-tune. People would sing their songs, and that's the lead vocal. The backgrounds, that was the backgrounds. They didn't have to fly them in. They sang the backgrounds all the way through. But the songwriting was so strong during those years. People really took time with the lyric and the melody. They crafted such beautiful songs that the songs are going to last hundreds and hundreds of years. There's no about, look at the Beatles catalog. Mm-hmm. It's as relevant today as it was the years it was created. And I attribute it to the great songwriters. People don't give the songwriters enough credit. Without the song, the songs make the artist to begin with. I always say that the very first song that makes the artist is the prototype for the rest of their career most of the time.
We've got a wonderful website people can visit, Ron Dante Online. It's rondante.com. You've got albums available, your anthology album, favorites, and much more. So if people want to find out what you're doing, where they can see you, or just get some great music, it's a great site to visit.
That's great. Nick, also, please come visit me on Facebook. I have two sites, and I'm always posting things every day about new things. I'm going to be doing a great auction of my Archie's memorabilia very soon for Valentine's Day. So I hope a lot of people come and visit.
I really appreciate you making time for us today.
You bet. I'm always happy to do it. Radio and you guys keep the music alive and well, and the stories alive and well. So thank you, Rich.
All right. Thank you. Be well, Ron.
Okay. Right. Stay safe.
All right. Bye-bye now. So much fun. The great Ron Dante talking with us here on Downtown.